Welcome to the 21-5 Show, a new podcast for professional pilots by professional pilots. I'm Max, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host Dylan. We're both professional pilots with experience in flight instruction, airlines, and business aviation.
Today, we're going to discuss post-retirement jobs for airline pilots. We'll talk to Ted Schwartz about his experience transitioning from Southwest Airlines to business aviation. Max and I will talk about side gigs for pilots and our experience with them. And then we'll share one of our favorite tales from the road. Well, you know, Max, one of my favorite hobbies is cruising pilot social media.
I'm aware.
Facebook, online forums. I love it all. I'll tell you what I have seen a bunch of on social media lately is airline pilots that are either retired or getting ready to retire, making posts about wanting to transition to business aviation in particular after they retire. You know, they want to keep flying and stay in the cockpit. And for anyone that's listening that has seen any of these posts, you probably know what happens next. Mandatory 40 post flame session from everybody.
Well, you know, there's always been this whole corporate versus airline guys. And mostly I think it's on the business aviation corporate side where they're not real keen on airline guys. And, you know, having done both, it's a more dynamic environment in business and, you know, in corporate aviation or charter or whatever. You know, you're filing your own flight plans, you're loading the bags, you're checking the weather, you're making a lot of, you know, decisions that are kind of already laid out for you. So there's all that. And you know, especially if you've been at the airlines for a long time, you're certainly not used to that. But I think the thing that really gets these guys fired up is when they, you know, show their willingness and interest in business aviation and then say what their experience is, you know, a bunch of type ratings with a B in front of it and 25,000 hours and this and that. And look, if you just say, I've been in the airlines for a while or my whole career or even say 20 years, whatever, everybody knows that you have a bunch of type ratings on, you know,
on type ratings that are 100% worthless in business and corporate aviation, by the way.
It's not to downplay that because getting every time you go to, you know, long-term training at the airlines and get a new type rating, it's stressful. You got to memorize a bunch of new stuff and it's, you know, it's hard, but you just got to know what your audience is. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, it seems everyone gets real inflamed about that. The reality of the matter is with the current pilot situation we're in and with the amount of retirements coming up at the airlines, there's going to be a big need for pilots everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, on the airline and the corporate side. But I think you're going to see most of the, at least younger or middle-aged, whatever, corporate guys are going to be going to the airlines. There's a huge draw for that right now, at least at our airport and I think everywhere else. From down from the Part 135 operators to the Fortune 100 companies. Everybody is leaving as business aviation figures out what to do. And I think we see pay coming up and things, but there's still a really big gap when you talk about pay, retirement, profit sharing, set schedule, benefits, all this stuff.
No responsibilities.
Yeah, no responsibilities. Or less responsibilities,
right.
I should say.
Yes. I guess we don't want to downplay the 150 people in the back of the airplane that you're responsible for.
Right. I should say that. But I think you're going to see, one, you know, there's this pilot shortage, so it's hard to find new pilots. Two, you see a bunch of business aviation pilots leaving for the airlines. And then with the increase in retirements at the airlines, you have a bunch of pilots that are retiring from the airlines, some of which are looking for a job or to keep flying because they want to or they need the money. You know, they still got four wives they're paying off. Who knows? You combine all of that, you're going to see a lot of more airline guys just because of the numbers trying to get into business aviation. So,
and honestly, like you touched on, I think business aviation is going to need those people.
Absolutely.
Because they have a lot to offer experience-wise. And as that vacuum gets filled from the bottom, you know, of the younger business aviation, corporate guy, charter guys getting sucked into the airlines, and then the top, the airline retirements is going to kind of backfill that, I think.
For sure. And, you know, the business aviation community is just going to have to become a little more open to the prospect. And so, yeah, you know, you have a few things. Those guys are older.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of experience, a lot more a lot of times than you might, you know, as a business aviation pilot, just because they fly a lot more. So when it comes to, you know, dealing with weather, navigating around thunderstorms, going into high traffic density areas, you know, working, doing the groundwork at O'Hare or Dulles or places like that, you know, those guys are probably going to be better. Now, when it comes to going to an uncontrolled airport, you know, ski town in the mountains,
visual approaches,
you know, circling approaches, at less than 1,000 feet.
Airplanes without auto throttles,
without HUDs, you know, so a lot of stuff. Yeah. There's going to be a little bit of a gap there. Loading bags, you know, trying to hoist an 80-pound bag over your head to get it in the back of a Gulfstream is, you know, challenging for everybody at some points. But, I think the guys are just going to have to be a little bit more receptive to it, because it's going to be a big pool of good, experienced, insurable pilots, you know?
That's a great point too, because the insurable / meeting the Argus Wyvern stuff, that is going to make a lot of those guys attractive.
And I was just talking to Ken Casey from our last episode about insurance, and the insurance requirements are actually going up, which would seem counterintuitive to the average experience level of pilots in business aviation is probably going down, because the guys with the experience are, a lot of them are going to the airline. So, so yeah, those guys have a lot to offer now, but from the perspective of, if you're a retired airline guy and you want to get into business aviation, one way to keep the people from getting so worked up about your post on social media is to know your audience.
Exactly. And I salute the guys that are getting on social media and trying to lay the groundwork and figure things out. Like, that's good. So I applaud that.
But if you're 65 and you've been doing something for 20 or 30 years and you're looking to do something related but totally different, like, good for you.
Yeah.
That takes some gusto.
Exactly. But I think the most important thing you can do when you are making these posts and trying to learn, well, I would say number one is, before you post anything, do some searches and do some reading first. That'll really help educate you. All you got to search in most of the social media, the message boards, is retired airline pilot, and you'll see a lot of the conversations.
or whatever post has the most comments.
Right, exactly. The most hateful comments, right? But honestly, here is what we typically see, and this is what to avoid. You get the retired airline pilot or soon-to-be retired airline pilot makes a post, said, hey, I'm getting ready to retire. I have 25,000 hours. I'm typed in the B, you know, this, Airbus, this. You know, I'd like to find a job. And then you get a lot of comments from the people, you know, you'll find that. And it seems like you see that post pretty much all the time.
Regularly. But that being said, that's the typical post, but we have seen other ones that are better worded.
Yeah.
And somebody that knows the audience says, hey guys, you know, I'm retiring from the airlines in a couple of months. I've been here a long time. But I'm ready to learn, excited about the opportunity. If anybody could help me out or steer me in the right direction, I'm open to anything.
Yeah, you know, that's better. And it really comes down to the attitude of the poster.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the thing. Recognizing that, hey, you're getting into a completely different business. You're in some ways starting back at zero. In other ways, not. But you will have a lot to learn. That is, I think, the key. The approach, the attitude, knowing your audience, that is certainly important. As far as some places to go, there are quite a few Facebook groups you can join. If you search professional pilots, you will see quite a few of those groups that you can join. That's a great spot. I personally think propilotworld.com is a really good resource.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Probably the best for people looking about business aviation, especially. There are a lot of airline pilots on there, but there's, I would say, more than half are business aviation pilots. So a lot of good information there. I mean, honestly, if you're a retired airline pilot or going to be, that is what I would do first. I'd go to that website and I just read that website for several days.
Yeah.
And that will give you a really good gauge of some things to think about.
And you may already be a member, because it's has a big section on airlines.
You know, I would say the hard thing is, and you and I have both been airline pilots and in corporate business aviation. And I remember at the airlines flying along, and you would talk to guys in the cockpit and they would tell you about, oh, their buddy's flying a Gulfstream or doing this. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions at the airlines about like what business aviation is and what they hear on the flight deck about that one guy who just retired and then got into some gravy train Gulfstream gig and flies, you know, 3 days a month. And I think there's a lot of rumors and misconceptions about that.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's not that easy to just jump in. And honestly, a Gulfstream job may sound appealing because you don't really know, but some of that is the hardest flying there is from a like schedule standpoint and physically demanding standpoint. That may not be the retirement job you want.
Yeah, absolutely. And from the size of your suitcase standpoint, yeah, you know,
exactly.
Big plane, go far.
I don't know. If it was me and I was retiring, I would be looking on the other end of the spectrum personally.
I'd like to find a guy that likes to ski a lot.
Yeah.
As a Citation 3 and
CJ3.
CJ3. Yeah, correct. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, like
91
honestly, I'd be looking at the other side of the scale here. Light jets, turboprops, like those would be probably in general some of the more enjoyable flying. Like they're just more fun airplanes to fly.
Sure.
And you're not going to be going on the 3 week long Europe tour, which sounds appealing once, but if you start doing that a bunch,
trust me,
you're not going to be, you know, most guys, that is not going to be the retirement job.
It's pretty fun for the first 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then that's when you hit the wall. That's when I do. And then by week three, I've done a couple of 30 day Europe trips. And
yeah.
By week three, you're just over it.
Yeah.
So,
and I think the other important thing to do if you're a retired airline pilot looking for it is you've got to know your local market. There are some cities that it's really good to, you know, be retired in and want to get involved. And there are some cities that aren't as good. And it seems like a lot of cities have different types of airplanes. So, for example, here in Scottsdale, for whatever reason, there are a ton of Falcon 2000s. I don't know why. That's just a lot of people own Falcon 2000s here. So if you were going to be a retired guy and that was an airplane you wanted to get into, in your mind, you might think, oh, Gulfstream, it'll make the most money. You know, I'll get the most pay. It's the biggest, best airplane. When in reality, that's not really as good of a type rating to have here in this particular city because there just aren't as many airframes as other ones. Yeah. LA, completely different story. But there are a lot of factors to think about in what is local to you. It's not just, you know, getting that specific type rating of some airplane that you think carries the most prestige. You've got to kind of know what's in your area.
Yeah, and Dylan and I both transitioned from the regional airlines to business aviation, but I think that's a lot different going from a retired airline pilot to business aviation. But up next, we have Ted Schwartz, who was kind of a mentor of mine, was the guy that first hired me into business aviation. He was a retired airline guy that got into a 135 certificate holder, was the director of operations, and also flew a Gulfstream. But he was there and originally hired me on my first beach shed job. So we're going to talk to Ted. He's one of the guys that I think did it the right way. And we'll hear from him.
We would also love to hear from our listeners. What do you guys think about this topic? I know it is definitely controversial. We see a lot of the activity online about it. Let us know. Emails info@21fivepodcast.com. Our socials are all at 215podcast. Coming up, here's Ted Schwartz. Ted, there's no way I can summarize your career, so why don't you just give us a little background, who you are, what have you done in aviation?
Hi, as you said, I'm Ted Schwartz. I graduated from Arizona State University and immediately was commissioned in the Air Force. Went to pilot training for the Air Force and was in for the next 22 and a half years. Flew a variety of airplanes, mostly fighters. Retired from the Air Force in 1989 and did a little consulting work, and especially with a company down in Dallas, an airline crew training company, and did the first turbojet examiner program for the FAA in 737s because the regular examiners had a hard time showing up for the check rides for the airline company. I guess we could say that a little more eloquently. There was a short little rephrase that and say there was a shortage of inspectors. And then I went to saw a lot of my friends having a lot of fun and not working very hard at Southwest Airlines. So I went there until retirement and was the director of operations for Southwest Jet for a year and a half, and then went to fly Gulfstream until 2010. I promised my wife I'd retire, and that lasted exactly 36 hours until Lockheed Martin called.
You did technically retire, though, right? So
then... So I guess it worked. They wanted me to come fly a test flight with them, and I went out and did that, and I guess it worked all right, because about a week later, I was at the Farnborough Air Show and flew the next couple, 3 years for Lockheed Martin.
So Ted's done a few things. My experience with Ted was he was actually the guy that first hired me in business aviation when I was, you know, at the regional airline, and I came to the charter operator that he was a director of operations for, and, you know, with a shirt, a tie on, and a resume looking for a job. And they were the ones that ultimately gave me one, got me into this side of the business. So Ted's been a close friend for a long time. And I thought with our previous discussion about retired airline guys coming into this side of the business and, you know, how some people view that as good or bad or indifferently, and how we think, you know, it'll probably be a big part of business aviation over the next few years for sure with this pilot situation. So I thought when we talked about that and about the right way to approach it when you're coming from the airlines, you know, Ted came to mind because he approached it knowing that it was very different, but also, you know, utilizing his experience in his past life, putting in a lot of effort to learn about this side of the business to perform, you know, very well as a director of operations. And he knew the rules better than everybody, like he was supposed to, not because he'd been doing it longer than everybody, but because he put in the effort and the work, and it was pretty good to see. So Ted, why don't you kind of tell us about from your retirement to from Southwest and then how you ended up flying Gulfstreams, getting inside in this side of the business?
Well, as retirement was approaching in, from Southwest Airlines, I had no real plan, no intentions of any particular thing. And one of the guys from Southwest Jet called and said, would you like to come and fly one of the smaller private jets for a celebrity? And I said, let me think about that. Went and looked and decided I wasn't really what I wanted to do. So they called back and said, would you like to be the director of operations? And I said, the director of what? And I did not really know much about that. But it sounded interesting, and it was a challenge, so pressed on with it. However, the very first day that I showed up, the FAA POI, the principal operations inspector, has showed up at a meeting and said, oh, another blankety-blank 121 useless captain. And that was my introduction to the business aviation. But as Max correctly said, it was a steep learning curve, especially to step in as director of operations, which I did not know that much about, but found out very quickly that compliance was the biggest part of that job. And learning all the rules and regulations and going to the various schools was very worthwhile, and learned a lot of things that I had not learned in a lot of military flying, a lot of airline flying. So many things are done for you automatically in the airlines. Just one quick example. At Southwest Airlines, they had a rule, if the weather was marginal, then you had to have a second alternate. And marginal was defined as 602. Why 602? Well, I never knew that until I went to the business jet aviation world. And that's the minimums on the back of most of your 10-9 pages.
So when you approach this, Ted, it sounds like you had kind of a specific mindset or an attitude. What was that attitude when you started in business aviation?
Well, throughout my life, I've always been a type A overachiever, although a lot of times my achievements weren't as high as I would have liked them to have been. But that's really the only attitude I could have in that job for the reasons I just said, because they expected me to not know anything, not do anything. But young guys like Max were depending on me knowing what I was doing. So it was a constant and quick learning curve, but very enjoyable at the same time.
So even though you had thousands of hours, prior experience in military and airlines, it sounds like you kind of approached it as, hey, I know I don't know a lot of things about this, but I'm willing to learn.
Exactly. Keep in mind that flying fighters, you come down initial, you come down, fly the runway heading, pitch out and land, taxi off the runway, the follow me truck takes you to the gate. And that's your sum total of responsibilities of getting to the gate. And the airline, a lot of people would like to think that the airline captain job is the most difficult job in the whole world. Well, is probably one of the most enjoyable and fun jobs I ever had. Yes, sure, you got to keep up with the weather, the fuel, and all the various things. But most things are done for you. You don't have to file a flight plan. You don't have to worry about clearances. You don't have to worry about prior permissions. You don't need to worry about most things that the you guys that have accomplished yourselves in business aviation have to do.
Yeah, that's a good point. When you look at the retirement numbers right now in the airlines, I think that there is going to be a large influx of retired airline pilots coming into business aviation. And I think business aviation needs that a little bit because we have so many younger guys leaving for the airlines. So it's almost like a very cyclical thing. What would you say to a colleague at Southwest Airlines that was getting ready to retire and maybe pursue a career in business aviation? Is there like one piece of advice that would stand above everything else? Or what would you tell them?
Be humble.
Yeah, that's good. That's good advice. It was funny because what Dylan and I were talking about is a lot of these guys say, hey, I'm retiring in a couple months, and they'll put a post on social media somewhere and it'll say, you know, I've got 25,000 hours in B757/67737727747 type ratings and blah, blah. And it's funny because while that's great, and it really is, and it's a lot of accomplishment, you have to know how your strengths pertain to that part of the industry. And so a bunch of Boeing type ratings aren't going to do you a ton of good in this business, but rather a post from the same guy that says, hey, I'm retiring. I've been flying at the airlines for 20 years and want to try and get into the business aviation and continue flying. And I'm willing, ready, and eager to learn would probably be a lot more effective of a post, to a lot of people in business aviation, because there is that stigma of the airline guys, versus the business aviation guys, which is silly in the end. And so it's, I think, like you said, it comes down to attitude and people willing to learn, realize it's different, and being humble, realize you're going to have to lift a bag and throw it in the back of the airplane and do some things you were done for you or that you'd never done before. So
I saw a saying online, a guy wrote, and he said, retired airline pilots bring a lot to the table. About 50% is useful.
But I wouldn't even venture to say that's the norm. And I'm sure that there's guys like that. But like I said, in my experience with Ted, no matter what, he's always been a very, very humble guy, and won't tell you about all the fighters he flew and, when he was a colonel in the Air Force and all this other stuff. You have to drag that out of him or hear it from somebody else that drug it out of him, because he just says, yeah, I'm the DO of Southwest Jet Aviation. And, he was doing the best he could to, and he did a really good job. So ran a very tight ship while I was there. And then Ted, I had the pleasure of flying with Ted after that on a G3 for a while. And we had my first trip over the North Atlantic was with Ted. A lot of firsts were with Ted in this business. So I thought it was appropriate we bring him in and tell his story.
Well, to blow Max's horn here for a minute, there's a side of business aviation that certainly in the airlines that you have, well, in the military also, you have to take care of the people. That's job number one. And of course, in the airlines, taking care of the passengers is job number one. But the passengers go away after 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is. Your employer in business aviation never goes away. And Max took a job with an individual, actually an individual's wife, that was somewhat difficult to deal with, and turned that totally around. And that sounds maybe like a small thing, but it's an important part of business aviation of making the owners feel comfortable and making the job, making the flying efficient, which Max did a great job in, that a lot of people didn't understand that side of the business, the people's side of the business.
Yeah, there's certainly a big element of that in business aviation. And like I always said, one of the big keys to success in business aviation is having the owner's wife like you.
The owner that Max and I work for on a larger business jet couldn't have been a more pleasant person. And Max and I were very fortunate in that respect. And in fact, we only saw him in long pants once.
Yeah, that's right. Some are better than others, right?
Yeah.
So. Well, anyway, that was, I think, kind of what we were looking to get, just to say, here's maybe an example of how guys that are looking to come to business aviation should approach this. Thanks for coming in, Ted. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ted. You know, another topic that kind of ties into this retired airline captain thing and kind of finding other employment is side gigs. And that's something that I think a fair amount of pilots have. And also, I've seen a lot of interest from current pilots looking for side gigs. So
sure.
You and I both have side gigs. So we thought, why don't we talk about it a little bit and what we do and maybe some thoughts on how it affects our career. What are the positives? What are the negatives? And what we've seen so far. So, Max, I know you've been doing something for a long time. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think my first side gig was when I moved from the airlines to business aviation. And I had a good schedule where I just had a lot of time off, and which was awesome for about 30 days. I just hung out by the pool and, you know, and then I was like, all right, I got to.
If you haven't seen Max with his shirt off, that's not real. You know, it was good. It was good for everybody
after
at the pool.
I started
pool
getting a lot of complaints and then I figured I better find the better use of my time.
Right.
So I think you and another friend of ours had gotten real estate licenses.
Yep.
And so I decided to pursue that and check it out. And it was cool because it worked great with the class schedule. It wasn't like you had to be there for 3 weeks, you know, in a row.
Mm-hmm.
You had to, you know, get, I don't know what it was, say 15 classes, and they had a rotating schedule of these classes. So, you know, you just had to check all the boxes and take those classes. And so if you're available that day, you go sit in a class and then grab the next one and whatever. So I got my and then take the test and you get your license.
It's all go at your own pace.
Yeah. Go at your own pace. You pass the test. So you get the hours and then you pass the test and then you had your license to learn, as they say, because you really don't know anything about practically selling real estate. So you have to have some sort of a mentor, you know, until you do a couple deals and figure it out. But so I've been doing that for quite some time. And it's worked out great, you know, for the most part. Sometimes it gets really tough and you have to know, you know, flying dictates your schedule, and then you have clients that dictate your schedule. And sometimes those cross paths and it gets a little interesting, but you know, that's why I have a business partner I've had for a long time. So if there's something I can't make because I'm traveling for work, she'll step in and open up that house or help out with whatever there is. So that's been super valuable. You kind of got to have a backup plan, I think. If you have a job where you have to be there to make it happen, you got to have some sort of a backup plan. And then more recently in the last few years, I purchased a business too that I run, you know, but that's flexible in that I go up there when I want to provide oversight, but I have on-site managers and this and that. And, you know, fortunately with technology these days, you can log into systems and cameras and all and provide a pretty good oversight, being offsite. But you also, again, you have to have good people that will manage it because, you know, I can't provide oversight when I'm on a 6 hour
you don't
flight
have that,
to Hawaii.
Like, the robot with the camera mounted on it just cruises around your business.
I have a Kickstarter one.
Get back to work. Employee theft detected.
Yeah, I could use that one.
But so in real estate, you mentioned you have your business partner. For those of our listeners that don't know real estate, there's actually a couple different ways that you can do it from a standpoint of having to be present so much. So what I'm talking about is being a listing agent versus a buyer's agent. Can you talk about that a little bit too? I know we're getting into the details a little bit, but I think it is worth,
sure,
because it's such a popular second job for agents or for pilots.
Sure. So I think that as a buyer's agent, you are required to spend generally more face-to-face time with your client because you're showing them property.
Yeah.
Now, I think any real estate agent wants to be efficient and spend all the time with their buyers is productive time. You're not wasting time looking at stuff that, you know. So I think what I've done there is it's really taught me how to manage my buyers, and that's using all of the tools in the multiple listing service, mm-hmm, and making sure your buyers know how to, every house they say they want to see, make sure they look on the map. Because if it backs a 4-lane road and you take your time and you drive them over there and show them the house and it backs a road, that could have been eliminated a long time ago. So look at satellite views. I try to get them to drive neighborhoods because a lot of times, you know, you'll have to go show them houses and the house, they love the house, hated the neighborhood. Well, they could have checked out the neighborhood and done some self-education there too. So you try and be efficient. So that way you can do more in the time you have available. But yeah, in the end, you have to be there to open up the house or have help. You know, mm-hmm, Dylan being a licensed agent, he's opened up houses for me too. And my business partner. So that's from a buyer standpoint. And then on the listing side, you know, the face-to-face time with the client is less, but it seems like a lot of times the overall communication via phone, email, and other agents and all of this stuff is a little bit more, which is can be done remotely.
Yeah.
You got to meet them for the initial listing appointment to list the house, you know, meet the photographer, maybe whatever you're going to do. But then after that, you can kind of manage it remotely because of the way the lockbox system works and all of that.
Yeah, that was the point I was getting towards. I think in general, I think a listing agent is a better setup if you're a pilot.
Yeah, but the reality of the matter is you don't get to pick.
Right. Right.
So,
well, sometimes I don't necessarily think that's true.
Well, I think here's what I'll say. For the majority of people that are doing selling real estate as a side gig,
mm-hmm.
I think you're going to be taking what comes, not necessarily steering towards what you want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But so, in general, I think that is like something to keep in mind. If you think
for sure.
that you're going to help a lot of people find homes, that is definitely more face-to-face time, which can be tough.
Yeah. But what I will say about real estate is remember a very powerful statistic in real estate is that 90% of people that get their real estate licenses never renew them in 2 years. Because it's not easy. Everyone thinks it's easy. You know, the housewife whose kids, you know, go off to college, oh, I'll be a real estate agent. It's a challenging, tough, tough job.
Yeah.
The number two sued profession in the country. I mean, there's a lot of risk. There can be a lot of reward.
Yeah.
But don't think it's easy. So
I think like, what's the number one sued?
Doctors.
Is it doctors? Yeah. I thought it was like male stripper or something. Yeah. This is not what I paid for. Yeah, it's definitely one of those. And in that industry, too, it's 80% of the, or I'm sorry, 20% of the agents do 80% of the deals in that, too, right?
Yeah, more like 10% do 90% of the deals. So,
yeah. So it is definitely good. You know, one other side gig related to real estate that we have seen one of our pilot buddies do was in the mortgage industry. He was a loan officer.
Yeah, he was a loan officer. Yeah. So he's a mortgage broker, essentially what he was. So
sure.
If you need to get a mortgage, you went to him, which, you know, you can do a lot of that remotely too.
Yep.
Nowadays with people being able to scan stuff from their phones and this and that, you know, people don't have to come into the office. So another good side gig for pilots might be a commercial drone operator. Because that's a big thing in real estate now, doing aerial photography and not just real estate. I mean, everything. It's exploding. So there's some shortcuts to becoming a commercial drone operator if you have a pilot certificate.
You know, it was interesting because I was thinking about that. And then I was also thinking, do I want to put my certificate on the line operating a drone?
Yep. That is what you're doing. So you're getting authorization in conjunction with your pilot certificate. So
yeah,
you can. I think there is risk there.
So I think you have to look at that and see what you're actually doing. You know, so a lot of opportunity in real estate for pilots, and we see it all the time. It's, you know, see it here in Phoenix quite often. So definitely doable. I have a completely different side gig. We're fortunate to have a really large avionics manufacturer here in Phoenix, and they hire professional pilots to consult on a lot of their technical products. So their avionics manuals and documentation like that, they prefer those to be written by active pilots and try and write everything in a language that pilots will understand. So I've been doing that for about 5 years, and that has been a really great side gig for me. Very little face-to-face time required. A lot of it can be done remotely with your laptop and your cell phone. It's not as lucrative as real estate, but it is nice in that I can work when I want.
Yeah. And it's a lot more flexible, I'd say.
It's very flexible. I actually work in video production. I make YouTube videos explaining the avionics systems for this manufacturer, and it's really cool. I love being able to use the knowledge I already have in conjunction with learning new things, especially about video production and other things like that. But to be able to draw from my existing knowledge base is really cool. I love that I'm able to parlay that. One of the things, though, regardless of your side gig, I think that is tough from a managing it on the road standpoint, is you definitely are going to have times when you're on a trip, you've been flying all day, you get to the hotel, all you want to do is relax or go have a beer with your coworker or whatever. But instead, you got to go to your room, open up your laptop and work for a few hours.
So many times.
And it's just that's the yin and the yang of the whole deal. Is there are times that you're going to have to make sacrifices.
Yeah, nothing's free.
Yeah, especially on the road. always, what I've noticed is the funner the destination, you know, it, then the more work you'll have to do while you're there, of course. So, you know, when you're in New York City or somewhere cool, then you're always going to be on the phone the whole time and vice versa. But it is a sacrifice that you have to make. And finding the right balance is important. You know, I think it's something we've all learned. You got to remain present in your flying job. You know, you have to be plugged in, but and that's tough to do if you've got a big real estate deal going or you've got a video project due or something like that.
But the aviation thing is just it has to be your number one priority is how I've always done it because it's high stakes. You know, you can't, errors can be very unforgivable in, in aviation. People can die. That's not going to happen in real estate. So you got to keep your focus. And,
I don't know. I've heard you brag about, oh man, we killed that deal.
Crushed a lot of deals.
That's right.
But yeah, you know, one of the other things too that I want to add is that having a side gig changed a lot for me too as I, when I was younger. And, you know, when I was young and we didn't have kids or anything like that, you know, it was a lot. I got laid off once and I wasn't stressed about it at all. I'm like, oh, there's lots of contract flying to do. I'll find another job, whatever. You know, all I have to pay is my rent and whatever. But once you have kids and things like that, and you start to see the recessions and people getting laid off and things, it's nice to, it was always gave me a lot of comfort. It helped me sleep at night to know that I had another way to make money besides aviation. Because as we all know, it goes up and down and it's, you know, very unlikely to find a professional pilot that hasn't lost a job, been laid off in their career. And so, you know, and that happened to me but I had another business. And so it was a lot less stressful and it helped me in my aviation career because I could be more selective about the job that I wanted to take. I didn't have to take the first thing that came to pay the mortgage. You know, I was able to find the right job and you know, that served me very well. So, side gigs, man.
Yeah. Get the side hustle on. That's what Uber calls it. And I think that with the sharing economy too, now there are a ton of opportunities on some other things. Uber, obviously, you're driving, doing the rideshare thing. I don't know how much that really pencils out, and that takes a lot of your time. The nice part about it is when you just turn it on when you want to do it, and you turn it off when it's
you
over.
You could literally be sitting reserve.
Right.
Driving Uber with your uniform in the trunk.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. You know? And you'll kind of be by the airport. You'll probably be by the airport.
That's right. I got to go to the airport. Yeah. You'll be going back and forth to the airport all day anyway.
You might get paid to commute into work. That way. All right. We may have to rethink everything. All right. So yeah, I think there's tons and tons of more opportunities.
God, if there's anybody out there that has done that, you have to let us know.
That would be the ultimate, right? Okay. So one of our listeners has probably done. Yeah. You got to let us know. And I think, another thing tied to that sharing economy stuff, the Airbnb, VRBO type stuff where you're kind of a property manager or landlord for stuff like that, or not a landlord, an owner that is renting it out through those. I think that's another really good side gig too.
Yeah.
That is, if you have professional management or some people that can actually maintain the property for you, that's a really nice deal.
I think you just got to be very careful too, to make sure that you keep priorities where they need to be. I mean, I've heard a story from a guy, flying for an airline that was a real estate agent and had clients coming to town or whatever. And he called in sick for his trip and the chief pilot got word of it. And
no pilot, I think you're mistaken because I don't think pilots call in sick when they're not
that's
sick.
That's true. It's very rare.
You're confused.
But, the chief pilot calls and goes, "Hey, my name's Bob and I'd like to buy a house." And guy's like, "Oh yeah." And he had a schedule in front of him and he goes, "I'm coming into town just for one day. Next Wednesday, are you available to show property?" The guy's like, yeah. And he was supposed to be on a trip. And
is this a real story?
It wasn't firsthand, but it was told by somebody that I would trust.
This sounds like a chief pilot's story they tell.
No, I would say that it's 85% probability of being true.
Okay.
And so anyway, that guy got busted and subsequently fired.
Hopefully, his real estate business was.
Don't get greedy.
Yeah, that's right.
That's how it is.
That's right. What do they say? Pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. Yeah, that's
Jim Cramer quote.
That's right. Well, those are, that's just a little bit about some of the side gigs that we're involved in and our thoughts on it, doing it as a professional pilot. Curious to hear what you guys think, our listeners. Do you have a side gig that works well with aviation? We'd love to hear about it. If you could let us know, hit us up on the socials at 215 Podcast. Send us an email, info@215podcast.com. Or if your side gig is a courier, so you could just deliver us a message or a telegram or something.
Wouldn't it be cool if you're one of those the couriers that deliver lost bags? So when you get off work, you could just hop in your van.
Yeah, that's and another good one.
Deliver a delayed bag or whatever.
Man, we got a lot of possibilities here. We might need to start our own service economy.
What if you were an airline pilot, but you also were the guys that push the wheelchairs between gates?
No, that's just a Southwest pilot. That's what. Yeah. Next up, our buddy Mike joins us again. This time, he tells us about doing extradition flights for the U.S. government. And then Max tells us a story about flying someone in the Witness Protection Program. You flew some of the most famous people in the world, obviously, did a lot of stuff like that. But Max was telling me you've also flown some people kind of on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to...
Oh, they were famous, but famous for other reasons. Yeah, I actually, we had to do some, I wouldn't even know how to say it without really giving it away, but we flew some real bad people that basically weren't allowed to be in the United States, and we took them back to where they had to go.
So it was like a deportation flight.
Yeah, you know, extraditing.
Extradition.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was. So we carried full teams with us, and we would kind of go over and make these runs of dropping people off.
So, oh, so this wasn't a one-time thing?
No. We did this quite a few times, and we spent a lot of time in Africa, which actually is an interesting place to fly. If you guys haven't spent any time flying there, it's kind of a just fly your plane to wherever you want to go. There's ATC, but separation is pretty minimal. And if, for example, one time we were coming into Zambia, and I'm coming in and I'm still at 22,000 feet, and I'm telling the controller, I'm like, hey, you know, we're 40 miles from the airport. I'm at 22,000 feet. You know, this isn't going to work if you don't get us down like right now. And he's like, I can't. And so I said, well, okay, you know, let's do a left-hand 360 then. So he's like, oh, approved. So next thing you know, from 22,000 feet down to about 1,500, we just made one long left-hand turn and a 2,500 foot per minute descent all the way down to the ground and landed there. And that's just kind of how it goes in Africa. You just have to really be able to adapt to not having anyone telling you what to do.
A lot of times you're flying over mid-continent. There's nobody there, right?
There's nobody there.
You're talking to BA on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or something, right?
You're just chatting with each other amongst the other aircraft while you're over there. So, yeah, it can get pretty interesting sometimes. And the radios are really weak there, too. Obviously, they don't have the real high transmitting
the high
capabilities. Yeah. So you find yourself losing contact all the time. You know, radar contact last. Oh, we found you again. Radar contact, and it's just
you're still alive.
Charlie is the other term that they use a lot. So,
yeah, I've heard that before on HF. What does anyone know what that means?
I think it's
you like know, I looked in the pilot control glossary. I didn't see anything.
Yeah, it's definitely not in the book, but you hear it a lot over there. They say Charlie all the time, and that just from what I've gathered means okay, I understand, or it's like us saying Roger.
Yeah, somebody listening to this is going to know. So if you do know, it's send us an email, info@215podcast.com. Let us know what Charlie means.
So, yeah, you find yourself in interesting situations there. I don't know if I can really talk about some of the people that we dropped off without really getting... You know, I mean,
then you'll be extradited also.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know where they would put me, but I'm pretty sure there's a few places that we don't know about that they could provide.
So run us through, like, without giving away any names or specific situations, like you get a call for a charter and do you know ahead of time that it's going to be an extradition flight or do they you just see Teterboro to, you know, somewhere in Africa?
For those, there's a lot of planning involved with those. The government likes to know exactly what's going on with the team that they're sending with you. They want to know, you know, they pretty much provide what needs to be done and they're working with you hand in hand of, you know, flight lengths, ETAs, you know, ETDs, you know, estimated time arrivals, departures. They want to know those to the minute because they have to coordinate with the other governments over there.
Oh,
you know, hey, we're coming in at this time and we need you guys because we can't just let them go off the airplane. They have to be received by that country. So there's some coordinating that has to be done there. And you'll find sometimes that in Africa things run a little slower than what we're accustomed to. Yeah, that's no joke over there.
What's the reason, and maybe people know this, I don't know, why the government doesn't use their own assets to move these people?
So a lot of times they initially will try like commercial flight, but for some of these dudes or sisters, you definitely don't want them sitting next to your daughter or even on any commercial airplane for that matter. You need some security, some heavy security. And occasionally when you're flying commercial, you'll happen to notice somebody that's in handcuffs or something like that. But that guy's a low, he's a low level threat. He's, you know, he's probably just finishing up in his time somewhere or getting supported somewhere else. And you can always tell with this, what the threat level of the guy is. If he's got one cop with him or one flight guy, then he's, you know, probably getting minimal. Off. He's just going home somewhere. But if he's carrying two, then you know that he's still somewhat of a threat, but he's going to be pretty chill on the flight. And then when you rent your own airplane to make this happen, you can pretty much assume that these guys are the ones you've read about in the news doing some pretty dirty stuff.
And so you guys, you would obviously have like a team of federal agents on board with you.
Yeah, we did.
And the whole... Did you have somebody like protecting the front or anything, or can you even say?
No, it wasn't. You didn't really need to. I mean, the quarters are so tight on our airplanes that, I mean, where are they going to go? They can come up and try to crash the airplane if they want, but they're going to have to get through six pretty well-trained dudes. And sometimes more, you just never know how many dudes are there, but you know, they make pretty good statements right out of the gate. Occasionally when they're coming off the bus, you can see who chimes up first, because they basically will drag him out of the bus and throw him on the ground, and they'll put him in what they call the burrito, which is a full size or a body size straitjacket. And so they call it the burrito.
Put him in the burrito.
It's got three handles on each side so that six dudes can carry this one dude up the plane. And so this guy, it's always funny to see which guy does it, because it happens every single time we did it. One guy, you know, it's usually the first guy. Says the enforcement officer will get on the bus and say, "Hey, all right, we need you to go this way." And he'll say, "Who knows what, you know, F you, bro, or right. I'm not going back. Make me do it." And they make him do it, man. They grab.
So they just got to set an example,
throw him off the ground. Yeah. And after that, everybody else gets on pleasantly like sheep.
It's interesting that those guys wouldn't be, you know, more in line to go home. Like maybe they've served their time. They're going home and now, why would they be giving everybody a hard time?
Yeah, most, depending on how you look at it, when these guys get home, they don't make it home all the way. They're essentially, they're wanted where they're going to. So I've had guys get off the airplane and say, you know, "I'm dead as soon as I get off this airplane. So do whatever you want." They've literally said that. I mean, it's just kind of, these people are not the people that should be flying commercial. And even their own society has kind of like ousted them. So,
yeah, I think the only people that get to fly private on the government's dime are, you know, besides congressmen.
Yeah.
You're either at the top of the barrel. Either guys that are really bad, that are just, you know, too big of a risk to put anywhere else, or guys that are witnesses. I've flown a couple witnesses before to, I used to fly them to like Mather Field. Where's that? Out by Sacramento, right? And you'd go and they'd park you out in this huge apron. And dude, I flew a guy that looked like straight out of Sopranos, like had the black rimmed like square glasses, like what was that guy in Sopranos? The old guy. I don't know. Anyway, and him, I noticed when he got on board, you know, on the manifesto, he says John Doe you have the marshals on and you're taking him there. A lot of times it was like a day trip because he was going to court to testify and then we'd zip him back to wherever. And you'd pull out on the big apron. And basically, he was at risk of being assassinated was the deal. And so they, you know, black Suburbans, dude, and you see guys up on the roofs and the whole deal. And this old guy, he's super nice guy, you know, whatever. He gets off the plane.
Yeah.
And I noticed he had a Ziploc bag with prescriptions in it. So I'm like, God, who is this guy? You know, I wanted to Google him. And obviously, his name's John Doe on the manifest. So he gets off the plane and I think I've outsmarted the whole thing. I'm like, well, I'll just I'll look at his prescriptions and I'll figure out his name. So I go back there after they leave and I, you know, grab this bag they left on the ground. I look at one of the bottles. John Doe.
John Doe all around, huh?
Yeah. And I was like, man, holy we got cow. This thing locked down tight. Yeah. But those guys were always pretty pleasant. I only did that a couple times.
Yeah. Our guys that we had, I mean, they were usually, hey, how long's the flight? They had pretty limited questions. And I mean, we were allowed to talk to them if they talked to us. The flight attendants, we didn't really let go back there. But sometimes if they were comfortable, I mean, they, you know, you could really do whatever you want because those guys weren't going to let anything happen to anyone.
Yeah. Right.
So tell them about how, like, I mean, these trips were gnarly. I mean, and it wasn't just like one guy a lot of times. It was multiple guys.
Yeah.
So they'd be going and they'd load up all these dudes and you had crews staged everywhere. The airplane never stopped moving. There's no overnights, you know,
except
until,
on the
until
end.
The job's done.
Yeah. So we would start out somewhere maybe like Puerto Rico or something like that. Generally, we would pick everybody up out of Florida and then we would take them to Puerto Rico where we'd have to get gas so that we could make our crossing. So we would get gas. And I mean,
from there, you go to Dakar?
There? Yeah. So then we would position a crew into Dakar 2 days before this whole thing so that they could get their rest and kind of adapt to the new time change and get them into Dakar. We would then go from Florida to Puerto Rico, get gas there, and then fly nonstop over. Yeah, obviously nonstop over to Dakar.
You can go one stop once.
Yeah, right. So we would get to Dakar and then we would do a crew swap because we would be pretty much timed out. That would be almost 10 hours of flying and right around a 14-hour duty day. So we would swap out there and then they would continue on and we would just we would have another crew in the next location. So 10 hours of flying there and drop everybody off. And then usually by that time, they could hit all three of the countries that they needed to hit or states or whatever they were at the time. And then they would spend the night there. And then they would just fly straight back, picking everybody up. So we would go from wherever we stopped, we would go back to Dakar, pick up the flight crew there and just, you know, get gas, do our lab dump and carry back on.
Your lab dump out of the bus tub.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and it's funny, actually, in Africa, when you're walking around on the ramp there and you're looking at the ground and there's little, like, you know, paper things everywhere. And you're kind of wondering what's going on until you see them dumping the lav on the ramp there. That's how they do the lav dump.
It's literally a dump.
It's literally just straight onto the ground. There's no truck or hose connection that they put onto it. They just, you know, pop open the hatch and then just let it drop. So those little papers and everything that you're walking around, wonder what they are and why the ground's blue is because of all that.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's an interesting place.
TIA.
So
Charlie.
So then from there, we would just fly all the way back. These guys wouldn't get off the airplane. They weren't allowed to get. Well, I mean, they could get off once we landed to kind of walk around the airplane.
You mean like the officers or whoever?
Yeah, they would stay on the airplane for the full 48, 36. I mean, whatever run.
Oh, because
it was.
They had they're like the governments wouldn't allow other.
Yeah, I mean,
foreign
they were basically there to work. So, I mean, we complain about being on the airplane for 10 hours at a time. And these guys were literally on it for 2 days straight. So sometimes more. So wow. It's kind of a ball buster, but it's interesting to see, you know.
Okay, that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks for trusting us with your time today. Do you have an idea for a segment or a great story to tell? Email us at info@215podcast.com. Check us out on the web at www.215podcast.com and on social media at 215 Podcast. Remember, 215 Podcast is spelled 215 Podcast.
If you like our show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. New episodes will be taking flight every couple of weeks. And until then, remember, flexibility is the key to air power.